Hey guys, this is the Vertical Guidance Podcast.
I'm Wyatt Fink.
And I'm Alex Tanger.
And we're interviewing pilots from around the industry about their flight training experiences.
We're just a couple young buck flight instructors working towards our thick goal of 1,000 hours.
And our goal is to make getting into the aviation industry easier by offering advice to people that are right on the edge of beginning their aviation journey.
So let's get into it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. All right, today we have Mike Trost on the podcast. He's a commercial instrument CFI, and he's also an ambassador for Piper Aircraft. Mike, welcome on today.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Alex and Wyatt. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for your time, man. I know you're a busy man working with Piper and all that, but I mean, we got to get some humble starts. Where'd you start at, Mike?
So in terms of getting into aviation, I kind of knew in middle school and high school, I kind of didn't want a job that would put me in an office all day. So I started exploring my options. I kind of saw how the aviation side of things worked, and I did Discovery Flight my freshman year in high school. I enjoyed it, and I decided, hey, maybe this is the lifestyle I kind of want. And from there, junior year, I got my private till senior year, and then started exploring my options for the universities and ended up at the University of North Dakota. And from there, I'm currently going to be a senior, finishing up, going to be starting my CFII, and then seeing where that takes me from there.
Okay. And was there anyone that like nudged you towards aviation, or were you just like, I want to go to the airport and do a Discovery flight?
Yeah, no one actually edged me to kind of do that. My father, he was in the Air Force. He never flew though, but he worked on avionics. So I was kind of always asking him quick questions because he was working on some F-111s and some other fighter jets at the time in the 80s. But I did check out the military options, and I just kind of realized it wasn't really for me, just with how extensive the commitment is. So I decided I was going to go the university route.
Okay. And then what made you choose UND?
Yeah, so I actually toured about, I would say, over a dozen flight schools across the country. The reason why UND stuck out to me the most was, first off, it's fleet size, it's student size in terms of being able to get in classes. The flight lab availability with the flight instructors was a big positive for me. Compared to other flight schools, the airport was super, super close to the actual campus. Grand Forks Airport's about 3 or 4 miles away from campus. So that was, you know, a huge deciding factor as well. Obviously, people talk about, you know, how does the cold weather affect your flying? I mean, every flight school has this kind of nitpicky issues, you know. But in terms of the flying, in my opinion, I think it's a great thing in terms of being able to learn how to fly in different conditions throughout the year. Grand Forks in the summer is beautiful. It's, you know, there's days I've seen it get up to high 90s, and I've seen as low as, you know, below 25 actual temps. So you get the whole spectrum there.
Yeah, you definitely get it all. Holy crap. But so yeah, UND is a part 141. There's also part 61s. So what were the benefits that you saw in a part 141 rather than 61?
Yeah. So when I got my private, I got it at a part 61 near an airport from my hometown in Chicago. And the differences there was 141 is a lot more strict. They have more of a structured program. With 61, I was actually the first student to go through this flight school by my house. So I was the first student to kind of get my feet wet, even for the flight school. And they kind of just saw how things went from there. After I came back from UND a year or two, just to kind of, you know, check in with everyone there, I kind of gave them a little bit of some tips and like, hey, maybe you guys should kind of change this a little bit in your syllabus. You know, this might help students out a little bit easier, and maybe you can use this to help for the ground school. But in terms of if I was to choose, I'm really glad I did part 61 just to kind of see how it was before I went into 141 and saw how that was. And then obviously if you don't, if you get your hours outside, if you're at a 61, it's 1500 hours to go to the airlines versus 1000 at a 141 school. So that with that restricted ATP, it's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, they might be coming up thinking about, oh, 61, 41. But even before they do that, why would someone want even want to get into aviation?
Right. So, yeah. So the other thing too is, you know, why would someone want to get into aviation? The biggest things that I, the reasons that I kind of chose that or can see somebody doing that is, first off, you have a different life, lifestyle. You have a different perspective. So not only do pilots get like a bird's eye view of seeing the world, but their job experiences can prove that they can do other things outside of one specific location. So they're, you know, they're traveling a lot. The job flexibility is huge too, because it's all about getting those hours, right? So you get those hours, you apply anywhere you want. It could be GA related, you know, general aviation related, or you can decide and go corporate or, you know, to the airlines or even work for a company. Like I'm currently interning at Piper Aircraft and just seeing those different options. The other things too is, you know, it improves your flight skills in terms of being able to, you know, kind of puddle jump between different jobs. And it's very financially rewarding in a way.
Okay. Yeah. And you said, you said you're the ambassador at Piper. And I mean, that's freaking crazy to be honest. Like, I don't know how do you find those different, like every summer and every winter, it seems like you find some different opportunity. I don't know how you dip your toes in all these different things, man.
Yeah. I try and explore as much of that as possible. After my freshman year at UND, I worked for a flight charter company out in Alaska, a small town called Talkeetna, Alaska. It's about 3 or 4 hour drive from Anchorage. And K2 Aviation specializes in scenic tours and dropping climbers off to climb Mount Denali. So there I was working as a ramper, as an intern, and also being able to fly right seat in some of the de Havilland otters and de Havilland beavers. So, you know, we would, you know, take families up from, you know, cruises and take them throughout the Alaska Range to see Mount Denali. And that was really, really eye-opening for me because I've never seen, you know, mountain flying before. And that really gave me kind of quite a bit of experience. And then from there, came back to UND, the whole COVID issue happened, kind of stayed there for the summer. And then in terms of the Piper thing, I got reached out through social media on Instagram from Piper and the University of North Dakota. And they said, hey, you know, UND was reached out by Piper and they're looking for a couple ambassadors from your flight school. Would you be interested in possibly doing it? And I kind of found out a little bit more information. It was a new program. They never had it before. So it was pretty cool to kind of, you know, set up some Zoom calls with Piper and kind of start this whole college Piper ambassador.
So it just kind of like fell on your lap then.
Yeah. Got a little bit lucky. But it was all through social media reach. Just from posting, you know, what I'm doing out at the airport, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends from high school, I only have two friends that fly. So a lot of people kept asking me questions. So that's when I would start posting about it and say like, hey, this is what's going on for the people that had questions. And UND saw that and reached out to me.
That's sweet. And it looked like there's some pretty badass flying up in Alaska. Tell me a little bit about that, man.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of crazy stuff, out at, Lake Hood Airport. That's the biggest sea place in the world. And I actually got a chance to fly a couple floats in and out of there. One of the pilots I got really close with up in Talkeetna, he owned a Mall M7 and I would want to go down to Anchorage to go on other tours. So K2 Aviation has a sister company called Russ Flight Service. And they're based in Anchorage and they're mostly a sea base. So they do a lot of the bear tours and kind of glacier tours out on the floats on the beavers. So it was really clutch because if you worked for Russ or you worked for K2, as long as you can get to the different locations, you can do one of the tours for free. So that's where I would hit up the pilot from K2 and say, hey, is there any chance I can go with you and get on a flight and get down to Anchorage and kind of, you know, get on all these tours. So that was my goal, was to do every single tour that I possibly could that the company provided. And I was very, very like grateful and fortunate to be able to do them because those tours are very, very expensive if you pay out of pocket. So,
geez. Yeah. So you were doing the tours up in Alaska. Was there any like sketchy moments at all? I feel like mountain flying is just like a different kind of flying, especially from Grand Forks where it's just a grid system.
Yeah.
They're going to hit maybe a cow or a tree, but out there you're hitting a mountain or something crazy.
Right. Yeah. That was the biggest difference too, is because I, to be completely honest, you know, being from a Chicago suburb, I never really saw mountains that big, you know. Mount Denali is the largest peak in North America, 20,310 feet. You know, it doesn't get much bigger than that. But the weather change is insane out there. You'll be going through the range, and the issue is that you go on the right side of the range. So when you go in, you know, you kind of enter on the downwind side of where the winds are kind of tunneling through, and the mountains are so high that you can't even climb over the tops of them because the planes we were flying were not pressurized. At times we would do the tours where we would wear oxygen masks. And that was if we were kind of going up to the peak and going to kind of see what kind of climbers are out at the top of the summit, which was really, really cool. But that was only on really pristine weather days that we could see that. But the issue, the real big issue out there in Alaska is this thing called flat light. So I've seen it a couple of times when you're flying out there, you kind of get stuck in the valley range of the mountaintops and the weather is kind of coming in, but the sun is setting behind that. And the reflection of the sun and the snow tops makes it very, very high albedo. So you can't see the difference between a mountaintop or a cloud. So you're pretty much just trusting your instruments. But, you know, these are planes from the 50s and 60s. Some of them were even from the older 40s. So it was pretty sketchy, but really, really cool to be able to experience that. And for some of the de Havilland Beavers, you know, these radial engines are so oil consuming that you would actually pour oil into the engine while you were in flight. There would be a dipstick port from the inside of the cockpit that you would pull the power to idle, almost kind of go in slow flight and pour oil in there. It was pretty crazy.
Really? Yep. So you're just pouring oil while you're flying to keep it rolling?
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, that's a little different than the flying we're doing.
Yeah, for sure. You just gotta hope you have enough because those radial engines just burn through it.
Oh yeah, right. Well, when we're flying, if we're a hair underneath the tab, we're like, oh gosh, we're gonna fall out of the sky.
Right.
You guys are filling it up when you're flying. That's nuts. Oh yeah. My gosh. But yeah, I mean, you had that opportunity and now you're in the Piper ambassador opportunity. What do you do?
Let me try and clear that up a little bit. So when I first started, I was at school in about August or September is when I kind of got reached out. So it was the beginning of the school year of the last year. And Piper reached out to me, and there's three other students from the University of North Dakota, Carly, Hunter, and Jordan. We're all at kind of different stages in the flight training, but what our purpose or plan was to do was to promote high schoolers through social media to kind of get their feet wet and get more knowledge on aviation. So I know when I was in high school, I didn't know a soul that was in aviation that was, you know, a mentor or a peer for me. So I kind of was trying to figure everything out myself. And that was really, really challenging. So the main focus was to have, you know, high schoolers or, you know, even not necessarily high schoolers, but people that are interested in aviation at, you know, a young adult stage to reach out and kind of realize the options that are out there. So we would post pictures or videos as to what we were doing at flight operations at UND. And from there, we would answer questions from kids that were kind of, you know, debating between Purdue, Embry-Riddle, University of North Dakota, you know, hey, why did you choose the school over the other schools? And that was the biggest focus that they had. And obviously they wanted us to, you know, promote Piper as the product, as, you know, the planes we use up there at UND specifically. So after that, we would do Zoom calls once a week, and then that turned into once a month. And me and Carly got the opportunity to get invited down here in Vero Beach for the summer. And what I'm currently doing here is a very wide variety of different tasks. When I first got down here, we did a lot of deliveries with ATP flight school out to Jacksonville, which I'm still currently doing. We take about 2 to 4 planes a week out there on every Thursday. And that's Jacksonville is just their main base. And then from there, they deliver the planes to the other flight schools. I've taken a Seminole, to Western Michigan. And then this weekend, I'm actually currently delivering a plane to North Dakota and Archer. But in terms of just delivering and faring, that's not all. It's seeing the sales aspect of flying. So it's really, really cool in the office at Piper. They have a person in charge of each country almost in a way. So the dealers get a call saying that they have a plane that was ordered. They reach out to the salespeople and make sure that plane gets ordered, because in Vero Beach, that's where every single Piper plane is currently built right now. They started out in Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, and worked their way over to transition to Vero Beach. But in terms of anything else that we do analytics. We do a lot of the marketing for the social media. And what's really, really cool about Piper is if I wanted to go out to the flight line, which I do probably 3 days a week, I go fly with the chief pilot, and he's the test pilot. So we fly the airplane for the first time. It actually doesn't have any paint on it at the time for this first flight. So that was a little bit scary for me. The first time I did it, for the first couple of weeks, you're getting an airplane that's never been in the air before. And you just hope everything works the way it should. And from there, there's a huge checklist you kind of go through. And what's really, really crazy is that every single plane is tested to its max limits. I remember Bart, he's the chief pilot. He looked over at me and he goes, "Hey, are you ready to hit VNE?" And I looked at him and I said, "Are you kidding?" And he said, "No, we have to do this in every single airplane before it's certified." So,
do you want to explain what VNE is really quick?
Yeah,
just in case people don't know.
Yeah, so VNE is just the every aircraft has a limitation, right? So it's the never exceed speed, and we hit that in the Seminole. And what we did from there was we got up to about 8,000 feet. We were at full power, gear was up, and we pitched that nose forward and trimmed really, really forward to be able to get that nosedive kind of set. We were at about a 20 degree angle down, and we hit the red arc, and we basically just hoped that the wings stayed on for a second. So that was really, really cool to see, but it's very, very, you got to know what you're doing. If you pull back too much, you can disrupt the tail and damage the skin on the tail. So what you do is you kind of pull the power to idle and you let the airplane kind of fly out of that dive. If you touch the trim tab at all on the trim wheel, you could rip off the trim tab or even part of the stabilator. So it's a little scary, but from there, after the plane gets kind of certified or tested, you land back. Let's say that there was a couple issues. Let's say it was kind of left wing heavy. The way that we can find that out is we'll be in normal cruise flight. The plane might kind of just start drifting a little bit to the left, and it might not be subtle. So what we'll do is we'll go up to a higher altitude, maybe 10,000 feet, and go kind of really close to max power. We'll be at a higher speed and kind of point that nose down just to get more airflow, and then it will dip more and more. So the reason why that happens is because the ailerons aren't calibrated correctly at first. Just putting them on the ground, everything's off by just a slightly, just even 1%. So they kind of have to calibrate them itself. So we'll get back on the ground. We'll let the mechanics know, hey, this plane might be left wing heavy. You got to tweak it a little bit. And then from there, we'll go up. We'll do another quick flight and just make sure it's fixed. If it's in terms of, avionics issue, there was one time where I did see an autopilot issue. This was actually really, really cool. So Bart asked me to go ahead and go fly in a M350, and Piper has this Meridian series. It's they have a M350, an M500, and an M600. The 350 is a single engine piston aircraft. It's the first pressurized piston aircraft in its class. It can fly up to 25,000 feet and be pressurized, and it can hold six people. So that was the plane we were flying for the day. And it was, we were trying to certify this aircraft. So this is the last step before, you know, it's out on the ramp, the FAA certifies it. This is before the customer purchases or accepts this airplane. So we take off out of Vero Beach. We do this thing called the 1,000 speed run is what Bart likes to call it, the chief pilot. So we take off, we set the altitude at 2992. We set the heading bug for 1,000 feet. And from there, we go full power, everything full forward, and we test everything, and we check the alternate static, see if there's the drop. We pretty much just test everything, right? And for some reason, we had full power in, but there's a way to kind of go ahead and force that throttle lever even one more percent farther than it should. You know, obviously where it will stop, you can push it just slightly more forward with more pressure. And the autopilot kicked on. And I thought Bart maybe hit, there's a they call it a toga button. So it's, it's a go around button if you were on an approach coming in. And he's writing something down on the clipboard, writing down the numbers from the airplane. And we started climbing at a 500 foot per minute climb. And it was very subtle that he didn't even feel it, but I noticed it right away because I'm just looking at the PFD MFD. And he looks over and he goes, did you hit the autopilot? And I said, no. And he goes, hold on a second. This might be a squawk. So we get back to, we were at like 2000 feet at this time. Cause we climbed. So we're at 2000 feet. He goes ahead and hits full power, but then he pushes an extra little bit more pressure to push that forward. And all of a sudden the autopilot kicked back on. So that was the first time that he's ever seen that. And it was super, super weird. We landed back at the airport. We told the mechanics right away, and they pulled apart the throttle assembly with the throttle lever next to the mixture. And they found out that there was a small ground wire that was kind of cut into when they put the wires together in the throttle casing. And every time that you would push forward on that throttle, it would cut into the wire for the autopilot. And the autopilot would automatically kick on. So no, it was really wild. Yeah.
So the autopilot just turn off, you just push it a little too far.
Yeah, the autopilot would just kick on, and it we were able to show on the mechanics on the ground, we would just turn on the battery master, and if you even just push the throttle forward, you can see that it would just pop up with the magenta.
Yeah, I bet those guys were like, what are you talking about? There's no way. And they open up, they're like, what the heck is this? Oh my gosh. But so because at Piper, you're looking at the test pilot side, you're looking at like the sales side, you're looking at all this. Does it like kind of like change your mind at all on like what you want to do future wise?
Yeah, for sure. So, there's a lot of different opportunities in the aviation side, but before I kind of got down here in Vero Beach, Florida for Piper Aircraft, I was not aware of the possibilities that were out there. You got the sales aspect that you can get into. And with that, it's not really just sales. Obviously, it sounds like it's just sales, but you'll be in charge of a specific country doing sales, and you'll be doing demo tours. Or if a dealer wants, has a customer come in and says, hey, they're debating between an M350 and an M600, you take them up and you show them the airplane. So you're getting quite a bit of flying. As a sales representative, you actually fly 500 to 600 hours per year, which is quite a bit. You're not just in an office every day. It's pretty split. And then what really cool aspect too is the trainer side. Piper just kind of came out with a new plane called the Piper Pilot 100i. And a lot of flight schools are starting to get that plane because it's at a lower cost and it's for the training purposes. But yeah, like you said, the test pilot opportunity is very, very cool to see it. That's such a slim percentage of the aviation side, but you just kind of got to get your foot in the door and experience that for the first time and see how that goes. I know every single week at Piper, they get calls from airline captains that retired. They have 12 to 15,000 hours that are trying to become a test pilot. And you have people that are even flying with 250 hours to try and be a test pilot. So they see the whole, broad spectrum from 250 hours to 12,000 hours. So that was really, really cool to see as well.
So are you going to give me a job, Mike?
You guys got to come down to Vero Beach and meet people at Piper.
Make the connections. God, yeah, set pretty nicely. But I mean, what's a future with this whole thing? Like, are you just going up to Grand Forks and posting more Instagram pics? Are you just, what are you doing now?
So my plan is to start instructing as a flight instructor in August at North Dakota. Hopefully, and my plan is to get the CFII course done with these RCRJ course in the fall. You're able to possibly do it if you get the CFII course done in a matter of time. But if not, if I graduate in the 4 years, my plan is to come back down here and work for Piper as a test training and testing as a test pilot. So I've talked to them quite a bit with that. And I'd be training with Bart, the chief pilot, for about 9 months to a year, and kind of grasping every, you know, all the little differences between every airplane, the different engines. And, you know, I think that's more my route. I really considered the sales position, but, you know, I want to fly 100% more of the time than, you know, kind of, I knew I didn't want to be in an office. So a professional pilot is definitely the route for me. And I can definitely see myself down here in the next couple months or even next year.
So with that background, test pilot training, do you need to have like an engineering degree of any sort to get into that? Cause I thought that there was something with, you need more education that wise.
Yeah. So you don't, for Piper aircraft specifically, for a lot of other testing you do, and that is more of the experimental actually. So the test piloting that I would try and get into is production test pilot versus the experimental. So Piper has two different sides of that, right? So let's say that they're trying something new, and they take up the engineers, they wear a full orange suit, and these guys know their stuff, you know. They go up there, they're wearing a parachute and a life jacket. You know, they go right over the Atlantic and they hope everything works out the way it should. But they go test things that way. And that's when they have wires, you know, running throughout the cabin. They have, it's basically a huge rig in a way that they
just bare kind of, there's nothing fancy with it.
The airplane's complete. They just want to add an addition. So they're currently doing something with the throttles and with the auto throttles. So they're going to kind of see what goes on there. So the FAA comes in a lot as well. And they just kind of come in, I think every week or every 2 weeks to fly with the test pilots, just to make sure they're kind of staying up to date with the standards. And then you have the production test pilots. So that's what Bart is doing. And he's the chief there, like I said, and that's kind of what is up my alley. So I would be, you know, testing to make sure the airplane out of the assembly line is the way it should, and it performs the way it should be.
Okay. That's pretty interesting. So is there like a cert for a test pilot? Is there like a ground school? Like what's training?
At Piper, if you get hired, if you're a test pilot, we currently have, I believe, 4 or 5. One of them just started. He's actually an older gentleman. He's 62. And he was working at 2 flight schools nearby, working with Piper aircraft. And what Piper looks for is they look for somebody as a test pilot that is very, very familiar with small airplanes. They aren't really looking for somebody that is flying big jets and big airlines. They want to know somebody that knows how to troubleshoot smaller airplanes, specifically Pipers they've flown their whole life. So this gentleman, he worked at this flight school for about 30 years and he only flew Piper airplanes. So that's what they were looking for, right? And in terms of his ground school, there's nothing specific he has to do, but in terms of the test pilot stuff, yes. He has to get checked out by the chief pilot. I don't quote me on anything with the hours wise, but he just has to do a bunch of flights in terms of that. And then the FAA has to sign him off in order for him to be able to certify airplanes for production.
Interesting. So do they put them into like going past V&E and like, oh, recover, like that kind of stuff or what?
Yeah. So like I said, with that checklist, you know, I get in the plane with Bart. He has a binder and he has a checklist for every airplane. It's very specific. And you got to check, you know, V&E, you got to hit that speed. You got to be able to go, you know, more than 60 degrees of bank, make sure everything's fine. You got to try and stall the airplane, make sure the stall speed kind of goes off where it should. And that's actually a really cool story I have. Me and Bart went up in a Meridian M350, and it's really simple up front in the avionics. It's a G1000, which we're very familiar with, even at, you know, different flight schools, especially at UND. And he goes, the plan today is we're going to go up, we're going to probably do 50 or 60 stalls, is what he told me. And I looked at him and I said, I said 50 to 60 stalls. And he said, yes. I said, okay. So, you know, he goes up, he does the first stall, he does it in a clean configuration, which means, you know, gears up, flaps up, right? So what we're looking for is a margin between 7 and 10 knots, but we really wanted to see the margin of 7 knots. So when we first started, we were setting up the stall computer, and the stall computer is located near the back by the tail. So he told me what's going to happen is we're going to stall the airplane. We're going to wait in here for that chime and that stall horn to go off. That's going to say stall, stall, stall. And we're going to wait and see how many knots difference it is from that stall horn going off to when the plane actually stalls.
Okay.
So let's just say it went off at 70, right? We hear stall, stall, stall at 70, and the airplane actually stalled at 68. So that's an issue. So he would say, hey, Mike, go run to the back, go tweak the stall computer. So I would take my headset off. I would kind of crawl my way back there, go to the tail, and had a small screwdriver, and I would turn this little screw on the computer a full 360 to do 1 knot. And we kind of saw where that good number was. So I was running up and down in this 350, probably 30 or 40 times before it got the way it should have. And we made sure that stall horn went off at that 7 to 10 knot range for clean configuration, flaps at 10, flaps at 25, or flaps full at 40. So that was really, really, really cool to see.
Just a whole lot of stalls. Oh my God.
Mike, do you guys ever spin these things?
They, for the engineering side, they go up and test them for spins. In terms of the production, we try to. So like, you know, with the Archer, you know how it's not certified for spins versus the Cessna 172. So we try and spin it, but the plane won't spin.
So have you gone up and tried it, or you just know people that have gone up and tried it?
The engineering side is where they try and actually put it into a specific spin where they, you know, kick it in. But in terms of the production side, when they do stalls, you know, they kind of just try and see if they can try and get it into a spin. But for the most part, the plane's already, it's assembled to the point where it shouldn't have any issues with that.
Yeah, with the arch design and all the dihedral and all that stuff. Yeah, those things are probably very tricky to get into a spin. They're pretty stable.
Right. And what's really, really cool at the factory is being able to go out, and I can just leave flight line or the office and kind of go out and go and sit in the factory all day. So I can go ahead and see, you know, hey, this is where, let's just say I see an order that UND purchased a new Archer. I can go track that serial number down and find out where that specific part is throughout the whole factory. And at Piper, 93% of every airplane is made right there in Vero Beach. The only stuff that isn't is like tires, you know, small little pieces of plastic that they just kind of order in, and different things like that, but everything's handmade. There's not a lot of machines at all. There's about 1,100 employees here in Vero Beach, which is insane.
That is pretty wild. So it's all handmade?
Everything is pretty much handmade except for we have two big machines where they go in and just kind of laser cut pieces
CNC
of metal.
Like CNC machines.
Right. Yeah. We have, some milling machines. We have a hydraulic press for pushing the metal into certain molds, but everything from there, the rivets, the avionics, even the folding and bending of the skin of the airplane is actually hand done. That's the process they've been doing since the 40s. And it's still the same way it has always been.
That's pretty wild. So then it's probably like each aircraft is slightly different in a way than if it's handmade. So it's not like a big difference, but every aircraft is kind of unique in its own way then, huh?
Absolutely. And that's where we see it on the test production side quite a bit. So obviously every airplane, has the different touch, versus me or you rolling the skin on, it's just slightly off, between, it's not 100, no plane can be 100%, right?
Yep.
So when we go up and do the test flying, that's where I told you where one plane kind of, or one of the wings will kind of drop in a way. So yep. That's where they go ahead and tweak it and say, hey, maybe this plane was right wing heavy. This next one could be left wing heavy. So that's the other thing that you kind of got to keep your eyes out for.
So it seems like quite a process putting together one of those planes then.
A UND Archer takes about 4 months from start to finish. A Seminole takes about 6 months, and any of the Meridians take anywhere from 9 months to a full year to actually complete. And wow. to put that in perspective, a Meridian 350, it's like I said, six passengers, it's a piston aircraft. It takes 5,500 man hours to complete one of those planes.
Kind of explains the price tag on it, huh?
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Well, you got some freaking wild stories. We'll definitely have to do another podcast. But hey, what's like another piece of advice you'd probably give someone trying to get started in aviation?
Yeah. In terms of, a kid interested in aviation, kind of exploring different career paths, I would say try and, as simple it is, try and shake as many hands as possible, but also do your research. The reason how I found out of the Alaska trip was I talked to my first aviation professor at UND, Professor Fultz.
Oh, yeah.
He told me about it. He said, hey, there's this job opening up in Alaska. And he knew that I was kind of a city kid. He knew I never really got the outdoors experience. And he told me I should check it out. And he said I had nothing to lose. And he was absolutely right about that. But really open your eyes up to doing your research in terms of looking up different opportunities that are out there. And even if it's, a plane ride away or a couple of states away or even a country away, go for it. You're young. You have the chance to do it. You have no big commitments at this age. So go see what's out there and kind of take the chance. So that's kind of what I kind of told myself going out to Alaska and even coming down here. I said, I have nothing to lose. Let's just go for it.
Hell yeah.
I think that's awesome, dude. I know I've been pretty absent on that work and we got busy.
Got to fill them boats.
But yeah, I think the shaking the hands thing or just meeting people is absolutely huge in aviation, at least, because it's like a super small community. When you obviously there's stuff everywhere, but in general somebody is always going to know somebody else, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like I work at a gas dock in the middle of Minnesota, and I've met some pretty crazy people the last week. Just it's going to be very helpful down the road, I hope, as long as I don't really screw it up.
Hey, good luck to you on that.
Yikes. Oh my gosh.
For sure. Sorry. We're just having fun.
Thanks again, Mike.
Hey, I appreciate you guys' time.
On, Mike.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, appreciate thank you.
No worries.
Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed the podcast.
If you have any questions for us, DM us on Instagram at vertical_guidance.
And don't forget to like and subscribe so we can get paid. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.